Okay, if we could be in order, we'll go ahead and get started. And this is session. This is session number 164. Myth, Mormonism, and the Jewish Objection, among others. And we ask you to silence your cell phones and other noisemakers. I remember one of the first times I heard somebody's cell phone went off in a Sunstone meeting. Unfortunately for the person, Will Bagley was speaking. And there have been several others earlier in the day during that session. And so Will says, "Shut that damn cell phone up." And I think that message came across. But you know what annoyance that is. Okay, our speakers, well, our speaker and our commentator, Clifton Holt Jolly is a Mormon convert to Judaism who considers himself faithful to both. For nearly a decade, he was a columnist for the Deseret News and writer for the Spoken Word. And for more than a decade, he taught at the LDS Church Educational System as a seminary principal, institute instructor, Book of Mormon instructor at BYU, and assistant professor of communications at BYU Hawaii. He is the author and director of two PBS documentaries, has published poems and essays, and is the father of six, the grandfather of 10, and the husband of but one wife, Abigail Reinberg. Now, I believe the respondent, Bonner Brett Ritchie, is not here. He's probably having the same problem a lot of us have had, taking forever to find lot 24 in this building. We were lucky we came yesterday and had about an hour to search around and find that. So maybe Bonner will show up, but at any rate, if he's here, then I'll go ahead and I'll introduce him when he comes, since you might want to correct my introduction. So thanks a lot for coming, and Cliff, it's yours.
Thank you. Brother Ritchie will be at a slight disadvantage since I was unable to get him a copy of this paper before the event.
Shouldn't matter.
That's what my wife said. She said, "Not hearing your paper is no disadvantage in responding to it." As has been mentioned, I'm a Mormon convert to Judaism, and I sometimes find myself torn between my culture and my conversion. Most recently, because of the criticism of Mitt Romney's tone-deaf insensitivity, this time by no less a luminary than Elie Wiesel. Speaking to the Huffington Post, the Nobel Peace Prize winner said that one of the sacraments of the Mormon Church is, quote, "not only objectionable, it's scandalous." He was speaking of the Mormon temple ceremony of proxy baptisms for the dead, and the recent discovery that his name had been submitted as ready for baptism. I hesitate to imagine the response to the more recent report that Anne Frank has been both baptized and confirmed a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, not once, but several times. But Wiesel's scheduled baptism was found out just in time. Had the discovery been made a little later, he might already be Brother Wiesel, which he does not find amusing. This follows on the continuing scandal of several years ago when the Mormon Church was discovered to be baptizing names harvested from Holocaust records, a discovery B'nai B'rith was no more amused by than Elie Wiesel is now. The Mormon Church claims to have stopped baptizing victims of the Holocaust, but it continues to baptize other deceased Jews, and evidently a few who are not. How you feel about the whole mess will depend on whether or not you are Jewish, Republican, and or Mormon. I'm conflicted by a sympathy for both cultures, especially so because Mormons feel a keen affinity to Jews. As a New Jersey rabbi once said to me upon learning I was from Utah, "Ah, yes, the one place on earth where I am a Gentile." It was was making a joke, of course, about the Mormon belief that members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have been chosen of God in these latter days, as Jews believe themselves still to be chosen. I discovered, by the way, about this affinity we feel for Jews from my wife, who is a Cantor's daughter, that this affinity is not reciprocated by the Jewish. Although while living in Utah, she was impressed by the Mormon enthusiasm for both her faith and her history. It's difficult for me as a convert to Judaism, even after 20 years, fully to appreciate the apprehension of the Jewish community regarding the assimilation believed to be an increasing result of the diaspora. Or is it diaspora, Paul?
Say it with confidence.
Tomato, tomato. Love me though he did, my wife's father would not have officiated in our marriage had I not previously converted to Judaism, because it would have been an affirmation of assimilation. Having been raised in the sacramental faith of Mormonism, I understood and respected such a deep commitment. That sacramentalism includes baptisms for both the living and the dead, which is not entirely dissimilar from accommodations made by other faiths for those who die absent baptism. Mormons defend the practice with two scriptures in the King James translation of the New Testament. One that insists on the necessity of baptism for salvation. The other in which the Apostle Paul defends the doctrine of resurrection of the dead by saying, "Else what shall they do which are baptized for the dead? If the dead rise not at all, why are they then baptized for the dead?" Which is no help with Elie Wiesel, since Judaism accepts neither the New Testament nor the necessity of Christian baptism. Although I must say that my conversion mikvah was remarkably similar to a Mormon baptism. Complete immersion, although you do it by yourself at the instruction of a rabbi, rather than having someone of authority do it for you. And I'll come back to that authority thing in just a minute. All of which is further complicated by the fact that when I describe Mormon baptism as a Christian sacrament, I offend a fundamental Christian community that does not regard Mormons as Christians, but cultists, which alarms Mormons no less than Elie Wiesel is alarmed by so nearly becoming a Mormon. As a convert to Judaism, I understand how little I am able so deeply to feel the assault that such insensitivity is to the future of my adopted culture and the very survival of my wife's religion. A good friend who is Jewish but whose children who have married Christians recently explained it to me. In another generation, he said, my father's name will be lost to Judaism. Having suffered so much to survive, many Jews feel that assimilation is accomplishing what pogroms could not. Even so liberal a thinker as the Jewish rabbi and philosopher Martin Buber, who spoke of Jesus as my brother rabbi, also spoke of what he referred to as a racial memory, a sense of community so important that without it, we cannot truly and deeply know who we are. For those of us, Mormons, whose families came to these valleys, in the case of my family, pulling hand carts, we should be able to at least empathize with this sentiment. And perhaps we do, so long as it does not stand between us and a potential convert, living or dead. When the Dalai Lama remarked that the best religion is the one into which you are born, Mormons know that he is speaking of Mormonism. As a person who was raised as a Mormon and is still faithful to my Mormonism, I understand how Mormons believe we are doing a good thing by baptizing as many as we can, providing each the opportunity of salvation, which may be either accepted or rejected by the baptized in the life to come. And I understand how Mormons don't understand why people like Elie Wiesel are so deeply offended, even if they haven't been put on a list to be baptized yet. And I sympathize with poor Mitt Romney. In one way or another, he and his Mormonism have pretty well upset everyone. He's accused of being insensitive to the poor. He is. The unemployed. He's never been. Christians. He's not. And now Jews. Never will be, never can be. He is even being attacked by the SPCA for transporting the family dog in a crate on top of his car. I'm going to go out on a limb here, even though my wife is a member, a virulent member of the SPCA, and I'm going to defend it. Because given the choice of riding in the car with him and his many perfect children, or in a cozy crate on the top of the car where I can feel the wind in my hair, my tongue hanging out. Even I would choose a crate on the top of the car. Mitt Romney evidently is a good Mormon and arguably a good Republican who loves his dog and believes he is a good Christian. But because he is a Mormon, many Baptists claim that he is not a Christian but a cultist. This is an important point for me personally because it is Baptist belief that Mormons are cultists that permitted me to become a Jew. Let me explain. It's a quick aside. When I was studying Judaism, seeking a community of worship in which I could be as comfortable as I once was serving in a bishopric or high council or fighting with my children in the pews at church, I had thought of converting to Judaism. But a Jewish conversion is difficult, although not so difficult, perhaps, as converting to or away from Mormonism. For me, the toughest part of conversion was not learning Hebrew, which I still refuse to do in spite of my wife's offers to teach me, or circumcision. I already was. Besides which, this is not required of a Reformed Jew, so long as you do not mind people wincing to discover that you are not. My stumbling block was a fairly standard part of the Jewish ceremony of conversion and commitment that requires the novitiate to disavow all other religions, which I was simply unwilling to do. My people have been Mormons since there has been such a thing to be. And I was not willing to disavow my history, the history of my mother, much less the religion of my mother and the family from which I come for nearly a century and a half. And my wife was not requiring me to be, nor her family. I think they were pretty happy I was not a Jew. So several rabbis told me that I could not convert until Rabbi Rosman. Rabbi Rosman said something that has changed my attitude about believing. And I should have always had this sense, and I don't know why I didn't. Rabbi Rosman said, "If you say you are Jewish, who am I to say you are not?" Imagine a bishop, one of the brethren, your grandmother. If you say you are a Mormon, Who am I to say you are not? Which did not mean that he did not have questions. He asked, should I be more concerned that you are a Mormon or that you are a Christian? It was a frank question, and it was also a revelation. I think I responded that I finally understand what the Torah and Talmud teach, that sometimes the answer is in the question, a really good question. And this is how I answered him. There is at least one apostle who will tell you that I am not much of a Mormon. And my friend Zig Ziglar, the biggest Baptist on the planet, will tell you that Mormons are not Christians. So, by someone's accounting, I am neither a Mormon nor a Christian. Rabbi Grossman said, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm sure that it's very Jewish. And that was that. In an instant, it was agreed that if I chose to be a Jew, no one would question the choice. And many Jewish writers have confirmed the same thing. Anyone prepared to take upon themselves the persecution of the name Jew should be entitled to it. As for that business about Zig Ziglar, Baptists, and Christians, if you don't think Bible Christians are serious about how deeply they abhor Mormonism, take some time to listen to an openly hostile commentator such as Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC. On second thought, don't listen to Lawrence O'Donnell. O'Donnell was an advisor on the TV program Big Love. How many of you watch Big Love? I began watching Big Love, and my wife finished watching Big Love. I stopped watching Big Love because if I hadn't watched the program, she couldn't argue with me about it. O'Donnell was an advisor on the TV program, and he also played an attorney who represented Mormons. If anyone can make you thankful for the McConkies and their representation of the church, Lawrence O'Donnell's make-believe attorney and subsequent all-too-real anti-Mormon is the guy to do it. His attacks are broad, distorted, largely without foundation, and always, always, always hateful. On April 3rd of 2012, in response to Mitt Romney's claim that President Barack Obama was trying to, quote, establish a religion in America known as secularism, O'Donnell brought up the origins of Mormonism. I quote, Mormonism was created by a guy in upstate New York in 1830 when he got caught having sex with a maid and explained to his wife that God told him to do it. 48 wives later, Joseph Smith's lifestyle was completely sanctified in the religion he invented to go with it, which Mitt Romney says he believes. Well, a critical method I employ when judging the criticism of serious critics, but which I will apply here to Lawrence O'Donnell, is to flip the criticism. Take the groundless attack O'Donnell makes of Joseph Smith, claiming him at other times to have been a pedophile. Take the vitriol with which he characterizes the history and practices of the Mormon Church and flip them to, oh, I don't know, say, Reform Judaism. Does anyone really think that he would get away with that? Imagine Lawrence O'Donnell saying on the air that historical Judaism was founded by a guy named Jacob who wanted a second wife. Or how about this? While Barack Obama is not himself a Muslim, Or perhaps since we're in Utah, some of you believe he is. There is no question that he is descended from Islamists and a tribal culture, both of which practice polygamy. O'Donnell was later forced to apologize. He says he wishes he could take back what he said. He's still on the air at NBC. Well, I find it more amusing than offensive. But what is not amusing is that this kind of nonsense plays a part in electing our presidents, when it shouldn't be permitted to play a part in electing a dog catcher. Although given recent criticisms, that may not be a metaphor that's considerate of Brother Romney. And who cares what Romney thinks today? When he has been forced by difficult opinion to think so many, many things over time. What George Will calls his very comfortable opinions. People used to talk about Romney Republicans and Goldwater Republicans. Anyone old enough to remember that when his father was a politician? And Romney himself ran as a Romney Republican when he campaigned for governor in Massachusetts. Else he could not have been elected. And now he is campaigning somewhere right of Goldwater. Else he could not have been nominated. Now, to his credit, the one belief to which he appears to have been constant, about which he has been unwavering, is his faith in Mormonism. Not his defense of Mormonism, he refuses to talk about it. And we should be happy with that. God knows what would happen to the church if Romney were to take up its defense. And all of this other stuff about what he believes or doesn't believe or is gradually becoming to believe is malleable. As Mormons, we should be able to think of Brother Romney in the eternal sense, a kind of Mormon string theory Romney. In the quantum of eternity, surely there are other myths out there, and who knows but that one of them is not trying to be all things to all people and failing to connect with anyone. Now, I don't want to make too big a thing of the connection between Mitt's lack of connection, his lack of personal warmth, and his Mormonism. Because if I were to do so, you're likely to think, hey, wait a minute, I'm very warm. But in cultures such as ours, fundamental, sacramental, magical cultures of healing and tongues and conversions and baptisms of the dead, there can be a tendency to value the institution through which the power is perceived to flow above the individual to whom the power is given or taken away. A friend of mine who ascended much higher in priesthood leadership than I did, or now ever shall, obviously, confided in me that the most difficult part of his excommunication was not the humiliation of having his indiscretions published. He was rather wounded by the loss of what he had taken to be love. I thought the brethren were more than my priesthood leaders, he said. I regarded them as friends. In addition to losing my membership, I lost my friends. He did not hear from them. He could not get a meeting from them. Other faiths are more open than we are about this sort of behavior. They call it a shunning. And it doesn't matter how much you believe in the idea that we should reprove at times with sharpness, afterwards showing an abundance of love. The fact is, we're much better at reproving with sharpness. And that's what another friend of mine felt when he was essentially disfellowshipped for a year. Felt shunned. when he asked for a meeting with one of the brethren, who was his friend, he was told that it would not be appropriate. He'd hoped to get a blessing. We tend to be chameleons in our church. We get together at events such as this and tell our inside jokes and mock the power we otherwise seek to obtain. And then we return to our sacrament services to sustain the very authority to which we yield so large a portion of our lives and our souls. Is it any wonder people question our authenticity? Question poor Mint's authenticity. His wife is authentic. Everyone recognizes that. What they aren't smart enough on the evening news to say is that it's because she can never aspire to be a bishop. She can afford authenticity. In the meantime, animal rights activists still say Romney shouldn't be permitted to own a dog. And the Tea Party says he isn't enough of a conservative to be a good representative of the Republican Party. But worst of all for me, B'nai B'rith and Elie Wiesel remind us that Romney's religion is the Mormon religion, and that somewhere we are still baptizing Jews. Poor Mitt, perhaps ultimately he will have to run as an independent everything. And in the meantime, while you're waiting for Romney, for that Romney you believe is out there somewhere, still threatening to arrive, vote Obama. Thank you.
Now, did Bonner Ritchie happen to show up? I thought if he just...
Thank heavens.
Yeah. I thought he might have the same problem some of others of us have had. Mark Shearer and I took about an hour yesterday to find the building, and most of the hour was spent trying to find unlisted Lot 24. We couldn't find any sign that Lot 24 was actually Lot 24. And we asked about three or four students come walking through the parking. We walked into a car in that lot. Is this Lot 24? And they didn't have any idea either. So you can see why it was kind of difficult. So maybe Bonner's still circling around like Mark and I did yesterday. unlike Elie Wiesel, who I do respect very much, his book, United, is just an outstanding book, which I had many, many students at Graceland read. But unlike Elie Wiesel, once I pass on to my reward, whatever that might be, I don't mind if you perform a baptism for me, because I figure if the LDS Church is the one church has claimed, then you've done me a tremendous favor that I will be eternally grateful to you for. But on the other hand, if it isn't, no harm done, it didn't cost me a nickel, so go ahead. And I'm 74, so you might not have to wait too long. But I do want to ask Cliff a serious question regarding the Bible, and then I'll throw it over to everybody else. You quote the passage in, I think it's Romans 15:29 about baptism of the dead. Wouldn't it be fair to say that we shouldn't make too much of that? That it's probably, it's one of the earliest New Testament documents, the just this brief reference in Romans, and the 21 New Testament writings after Romans, nobody ever mentions it. So wouldn't it be better to assume it was an early practice, maybe in some local community, a very small part of the segment of Christianity, which faded away? So, you can use that mic over there, because I'm going to try to get people to use this mic.
Are you a Mormon? I know that's what all of the well-informed and educated Christians point out.
I claim
well,
that.
Well, that's Mormon. I don't really care about any of that. I'm happy to get any affirmation of the faith that I can, wherever I can find it. And as a Jew, I believe that the Bible is all nice stories anyway. But let me respond to what you firstly said about how no harm is done. I assure you, if Cantor Wineflesh, my father-in-law, who has gone to his glory, has discovered that Mormonism is correct, he is powerfully pissed off. He is not happy about it. He does not want you to do his temple work. You know, he is still up there arguing with God, which Jews believe they have a right to do. There's a wonderful story I'll tell very quickly, which my rabbi told me. There was an old rabbi living in a small community in Russia in about the 15th or 16th century. Very well-known rabbi, but he was very considerate of the young rabbi who led the synagogue, and so he never participated in meetings. But finally there was this big argument that came up, and he listened, and he put up with all the nonsense of youngsters, and so finally he said, look, so it's time to get on with the business of Torah. Let's forget about these arguments. This is the way it is. And our young rabbi said, you know, you've been a member of this synagogue for what, 9, 10 years? You never say anything? And now you think you can speak up and tell us what to believe? Now the rabbi is really upset. He says, okay, fine. To prove my point, tomorrow the tree that is south of the synagogue will be replanted to the north of the synagogue by God. The next morning, everybody got up early to see. Sure enough, there's the tree north of the synagogue. And the young rabbi said, well, that's a nice trick, but what purpose does it serve? I mean, it doesn't plant grain, it doesn't harvest crops. And the rabbi says, fine. Tomorrow morning, the river that flows down the hill by the synagogue will be flowing up the hill by God's command. The next morning, sure enough, there the river was flowing up the hill. The young rabbi says, swell, now it won't turn the wheel that grinds the grain, we're going to start. Now, what purpose can that be? The rabbi finally said, fine. God will now speak to you and tell you that I'm right. A booming voice comes from heaven and says, he's right. The young rabbi looks up to heaven and says, you know, all this time, you never speak, you never say anything to us at all. And now you think you can just butt in and take his side. He never speaks, never says anything at all. And from heaven comes the sound of God's voice saying, you know, he's got a point. Jews get to argue more than we do. They get to consider the scriptures. They get to wonder about the scriptures. They get to not always have to know.
Okay. The tapes of these meetings, you know, we like to have the questions come on the tape clear, and usually when the questions asked from the floor, the comment from the floor, they usually can't be heard by the, and I've bought many of these tapes in the past. I think if we all came up and just form a line in this direction, come and speak, come and get in line, and raise your questions or comments to Bonner, I'm sorry, to Cliff, and I wonder if it would be a good idea for you to stand when you answer, because there's a whole segment of the population back there that can't see you.
I'll stand.
Okay.
Better to watch on the back projector.
Since you are versed in Judaism and you know more about it, I've had just a curious question for a while. Before Jesus began his ministry and taught people things, he came to John the Baptist, who was baptizing people.
Yeah.
According to what he understood of the Jewish way to do things.
Yeah.
Was that similar to what you were describing, or how long had the Jews thought about baptizing in the wilderness kind of things?
Well, Jews do practice ritual cleansings. They call them mikvahs.
Okay.
Not Reform Jews, which I am so much, because there are a number of these that are punishing the women, the ritual cleansings after the menstrual cycle and so forth, are part of a really primitive tradition that women are unclean and must be cleansed. institutions put together, as any woman will tell you, by men. And so normally, even Reform Jews don't have mikvahs. But my rabbi pointed out that since I was marrying into her family, which was a cantorial family of some standing, that it would be a good thing to go all the way. And I liked it because it was so much like my Mormon baptism. It just kind of confirmed everything for me, which I'm sure doesn't mean anything at all.
Thank you.
It's good for me.
Next.
In our Master Testament meeting a couple Sundays ago, a sister stood up and talked about her son who was inactive. And he worked someplace where people didn't know he was Mormon. And finally, one of his co-workers came up to him and said, "Are you Mormon?" And he said, "Well, yeah, why? How do you know?" And he said, "You don't tell off-color stories, you don't swear, you're very kind to everyone. I just kind of put it together." And so this young man was telling his mother, he's been inactive for many years, he was telling his mother that. And then he said, "You know, Mom, I've been inactive in Mormonism for a long time. The Mormon has been still active in me." And it still is in you too, Clifton, which I think is a nice gift to all of us that it is. And that you're both Mormon and Jewish means that there's at least two of you. You and Jesus.
Bob Reese used to be the second most Christian gentleman. Gene England died. He's now a most Christian gentleman. Jews have a word for this. I can't spell it, but it's pronounced this way. Of course. Still both in me. Thank you.
Step on up. Oh, good idea. State your name, too.
My name's Bill Bradshaw. And the question I'd like your response to is, have we reached the point in our electoral attitudes that you just can't win unless you try to be all things to all people? And as much as we squirm and may feel uncomfortable in the lack of, say, political integrity, the unwillingness to take a stand. Can we change that? Why are we in the predicament that we're in? Can we do something about it? Can't we honor people as potential candidates, as candidates for office, for who they are and what they stand for, and somehow honor diversity without being so divisive?
Never run for office. I don't know politics that well, but I did participate on a panel some years ago in Washington, D.C., with a lot of communicators whose business it was to run political campaigns. And their consensus was that a political campaign is a war. It's not an expression of ideas. It's not seeking the best person. It's a war. And in war, there's only one thing that matters, and that's winning. Doesn't matter how virtuous you were, how high-minded you were during the war. If you lose the war, it's all over. There is no virtue. There is no high-mindedness. And so in that philosophy, in that ethical world, anything is permissible to win, at which point you can go back to being good. And that's happening in both of the campaigns now. You know, everybody is saying how dirty both of the campaigns are, and then gleefully saying which has been most successfully dirty. So, no, I don't think it's going to change. But it's been that way since the beginning of our nation. I mean, they aren't nearly as bad as when guys used to kill each other on the Senate floor over ideas. Yeah.
Well, I think Senator Sumner didn't die. He just was incapacitated for 3 years. if I could add something, go ahead. I'm not Paul. If I could add something, go ahead. We can't make it. Oh, okay. It seems to me that a two-party system like we have requires a great deal of compromise, which means that the parties have to put together a coalition of enough constituencies to make a majority. And yet, if you compromise like we all have, you're going to be seen as, you know, phony. But we really don't need people who are compromising in public office, do we?
This is Paul Tostano. I've been waiting for this opportunity for about 30 years, and I want to win.
In answer to this question about the conflict, I have a story to tell, which you may have heard. It's a story about a rabbi and a cantor. Every morning they go into the synagogue early in the morning, and they would pray. And they would get on their knees, and they would say, "Oh Lord, we are nothing before thee." Every morning, "Look upon us, for we are nothing before thee." And one morning, the janitor in the back of the synagogue heard this. And he observed this morning after morning, until one day, after the rabbi and the cantor had prayed, the janitor got down on his knees in the back of the synagogue and said, "Oh Lord, I am nothing." And the cantor heard it at the elbow of the rabbi and said, "Get a load of who thinks he's enough." And I think that's the problem, is that everybody wants to be the chosen of God. Everybody wants to be the chosen. And some tribal people believe you become chosen by achieving purity by exclusion. And others think you achieve purity by inclusion. But not everybody gets included, so there's an element of exclusion. And it's this horrible sibling rivalry, which is not only at the root of Judaism, it's at the root of every real religion. If you look into it, there's a rivalry in there to try to beat out everybody else to the favor of God. And of course, you can't love people that you're in competition with, so the warfare that Clifton talks about as part of our politics is endemic in the religious traditions. It's something we have to rise above, but it's almost impossible.
And this issue of chosen, if you get a chance to attend the Reformed Jewish Friday night service, which I would want to do it sometime, because you'll find that in the liturgy, over and over and over again, they're reminding themselves what it means to be chosen. Because there's nothing else that we very seldom do in Mormonism. We say we're chosen, we teach our children to know that they're chosen. But in Judaism, they're always pleading with God, "Don't let us be lifted up. Don't let us become proud. Help us to know that we are chosen to serve." And if you take a look at the Jewish tradition in terms of our politics, in the civil rights issues, in women's rights, in all of these issues that Mormonism once led in. You know, we had women voting when they weren't voting in most of the United States. And somewhere along the line, they became good Protestants. It happens.
Yeah, Bob.
I was telling Gary when I finally was, Clifton was talking. First of all, there was an advantage to Clifton being a Jew, because when my wife was very ill this past year and passed away in February, I was probably the only person in the church who had his name in two different temples, Jewish and Mormon. I told Gail, Clifton's wife, and sitting next to her, I said, Clifton was saying, I finally figured out why he converted to Judaism. Most of us are content to be chosen by one God and one tradition. Mm-hmm. Clifton now has been chosen by, he's part of two chosen people.
We're
glad.
I'm just a little confused. I can understand you being Jewish, or I can understand you being Mormon, and I'm confused how you can kind of embrace both. In light of Deuteronomy 6:4, Shema Yisrael Adonai, Adonai Elokeinu Adonai Echad, it seemed like, you know, that there's one God there in an absolute sense. I'm just, Are you being Mitt Romney?
No.
Well, it's worked for me. It's worked for me.
Stand up.
It's a conundrum, isn't it? It's a paradox. Now, I cheer myself up with that by saying my father, who was a doctor of psychology, said that one of the great evidences of maturity is being able to bear a paradox. And so the Mormon side of me, I love the New Testament. And the Jewish side of me loves the Old Testament. And I love the stories in both of them. I taught Book of Mormon at BYU. I love the Book of Mormon. I love the stories of the Book of Mormon. But I'm not confused by the fact that they are stories. And I don't feel a need when the National Geographic Society discovers that none of the Indians are Jewish. I don't feel compelled, as farm cells, to commit its whole existence for the next many months to try to explain why the Indians aren't Lamanites. Of course they're Lamanites. I was on an Indian mission. I promised them they were Lamanites. Spencer W. Kimball was an apostle. He told me to promise them that they were Lamanites. And the fact that their genealogy does not give them the blood lineage of Lamanites, does that mean they're no longer Lamanites? I mean, do we all really believe that we are Ephraim? Well, except me, I'm not Judah, but nevertheless. Now, you see, these problems that we have because of our stories that separate us from one another are the problem Paul talks about. The exclusivism of Mormonism, the exclusivism of Judaism, the exclusivism of any faith that would say, no, you are not. You are the other, as Buber says. This is the beginning of permitting us to do terrible things to one another, as we do on a daily basis because of our Mormonism, because of our Judaism, and because of our confidence in stories that were never intended to be more than stories.
Come on up. Yeah, come on up ahead of time. Get in line, you're ready to step to the mic and turn it up.
Oh, thanks. Well, my name is Mark. So,
one of the things that strikes me as a Jew, actually, and it's not bothered me, but the baptism by Mormons doesn't bother me, but I think I know what's going on, and it doesn't have to do with heaven. It has to do with the fact that when somebody baptizes one of your relatives posthumously, they're saying they need something.
Yeah.
And Jews are very anxious that, tend to be, that non-Jews recognize that their deal is good all the way through. It occurs to me that Mormons also have that problem when evangelicals say you're not Christians. I mean, why should it bother you?
Yeah.
Or them, or whatever you are. So I think that's really the question to pose to both groups. Why do we care whether anyone else says we need something or we're not something?
That was a nice say, because at Sunstone it's so hard to know what anyone is and how many different things you have in the room at any one time. It's one of the gifts of Sunstone.
All right, so Clifton, along these lines, I often hear from Orthodox Mormons that we should be baptizing these Jews, even if they died in the Holocaust, even if it offends Jews today. We should do it because we love them and we absolutely believe that they must accept the Mormon baptism to be saved, and someday they'll thank us. We absolutely have to do it. And they're puzzled by the church's reticence and step back and refusal to do it and actually taking names off the rolls. So my question is, first of all, what would the Jews do today, the modern Jewish world do, if the church had taken that position and said, no, we love you, and even though it offends you, we're going to do it anyway? And then the second question I would have given to Bonner, but he's not here, isn't the church's refusal to do that and to step back and say, okay, we won't baptize any Jews and we'll take the names off the rolls, isn't that an admission that maybe it doesn't matter, and doesn't that go directly against the church's counsel to the members today that get to the temple and do temple work? It's very, very, very important. It must be done now.
Well, the second question first. The church has always been good at politics. And so when the Jews got upset, the church had no problem backing away. I mean, come on. You know, and so that was a political move. It was absolutely essential. It's like getting rid of polygamy or accepting blacks into the priesthood. All of these things are issues that are resolved over time, and politics plays a part in them. So I don't have a problem essentially with that. As regards our need to baptize for the dead, I always thought that the baptisms for the dead were more for us than for the dead, because I don't believe in a God that keeps anybody out of heaven because his name got lost along the way. You know, it's on its way to the temple, it's been out of the book, trampled, kids picked it up, scribbled on it. Don't go to heaven. I mean, that's unreasonable. And none of our stories suggest that. So we don't baptize for the dead. For the dead, we baptize for the dead for the same reason that the Jews say the names of the dead at every service. So that we will not forget our dead. We will not forget where we came from. We will not forget who we are. That's why we baptize for the dead. And realizing that it interferes with somebody else's remembering who they are should be all that we need. You know, let's not baptize Jews anymore. There's so many Muslims.
Yeah, Kim McCall here. He will bring truth.
So I normally try to do that. I don't have some piercing question, and I'm not going to do that this time. I'm just going to tell a tiny story. I've served a mission. I love the church, and I would love to see lots of people join the church. I was really good friends with a Jewish woman at one point, and we were palling around together, and one day she said, "You know, Kim, I just don't understand why you want to baptize Jews. Because if you were really successful at that, we'd all be Mormon." And there's something about, you know, for me, the respect that I have for Judaism, for the trials it's been through, for the intelligence and openness of the discussions, that the world would be incredibly much poorer, and my life would be incredibly much poorer if Jews were to disappear. And I don't want to baptize them yet. Well, unless they really want it. You know, I don't want to proselyte. I don't want to have a mission to the Jews, because for that reason.
Yeah, the Jewish side of me says, good. The Mormon side of me says, don't give up yet. And my wife says, every guy she ever meets knew a Jewish girl once upon a time. If you think God chooses people and then moves on and chooses other people, I don't think you get the story. You know, I don't think you get what it means. At least not for me. I don't think you can be a Mormon without understanding the importance of the Jewish calling, what it means, and how non-exclusive it is, you know, how encompassing it is intended to be. All the Semitic peoples and all the non-Semitic peoples together. And whenever we begin to think that our ordinances are more important than the people they serve, we miss the point. You know, we forget, we don't understand that ordinances are not in themselves magical. They're what we do to try to participate in the magic.
Okay, we only have about 4 minutes left, and we don't have to use every minute because, for some of us, the most valuable time is the socializing outside of the meeting. But if there is anybody that really desperately wants that last question, go ahead and come forward, otherwise we'll just conclude. Well, thank you all for coming.